Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast. To search for other podcasts you might like, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
It's our regular look at technology for the next 90 minutes and our tech phone-in with Fevzi Turkalp. So whatever your question, maybe you're looking for a new tablet, you've got Wi-Fi problems, or you just want to find out a bit more about VR, he is the man to answer your questions. So he's going to be here until 3:30, plenty of time to get in touch. The numbers you need, give us a call on 0500 909 693. You can text your questions in to 85058, or you can get in touch on social media at BBC 5 Live. So yes, if you've got a gadget gripe or you're having trouble with your tech, our gadget detective Fevzi Turkalp is here to help. Good morning, Fevzi.
Morning.
So our tech phone-in and gadget phone-in, we're here for 90 minutes this morning, so lots of time for you to get in touch. And gadget permitting, you can give us a call, 0500 909 693. Send us a text to 85058 or email upallnight@bbc.co.uk. And we're at 5Live on social media, so plenty of ways to get in touch. And Fevzi, we've already got people getting in touch with some of their queries, so we'll crack on with some of these straight away. Adam has texted in saying, even after turning the settings off and asking me to tell it about new Wi-Fi networks on my iPhone, I still get interrupted when listening to BBC radio or similar things. Any thoughts?
Is this interrupted by another person or your Wi-Fi is interrupted?
I'm guessing I'm guessing from what he said that it keeps going between Wi-Fi networks. So I have this when I walk out of this building. If I'm listening to something, so I'm listening to 5 Live on the way out, and then I get to a patch where there's Wi-Fi and my phone tries to get onto the Wi-Fi when I've been on 4G, and then I lose signal because it can't get on because it's one of those, like an O2 network or something, and it does interrupt what I'm listening to. Yeah. So I'm guessing it's that kind of issue.
I mean, if it's that, that's actually very hard to prevent because it's trying its best to do the right thing, but it can't quite. It's never going to be seamless, is it? I mean, that's it's a little bit like you know the guys that used to twiddle plates on long sticks.
Yes,
and they have to run from one to the other, and it's all a bit like that. It's rather tricky. If it is trying to switch between other networks and that you don't want it to, then you can tell it to forget those networks, and therefore it won't switch to those, because assuming it's a password protected network, it won't do anything with it. So that's the only thing I could really suggest. Other than that, when it's going from cellular network to a valid Wi-Fi, you are going to have that. I mean, the only thing I can really suggest is you sort of pause it, give it a chance to catch up again, and if necessary even restart it. And it's not perfect, but that's part of the problem, because we don't really have, you know, they used to have this technology called WiMAX, which was meant to cover whole cities. That sort of thing will come, and that will make a big difference as well, because that's the sort of thing that stops us from having, decent internet radio in our cars very often as well, is that we're relying on cell phone networks.
Yeah.
But I think vis-a-vis this particular problem, if it's going from one valid network to another, you know, it's not going to be a completely seamless handover, unfortunately.
Okay, we've got a question from Nick. I want to set up a mobile office and I want to connect a decent specification computer to a mobile network. I've been told about tethering. Is that going to present any issues for me?
So with tethering is the ability to use the data provided to you by your mobile phone provider on a SIM contract, or even pay-as-you-go sometimes, to share that data across other devices. So, for example, you might have a smartphone with a SIM in it, which will, you know, obviously do data as well as calls. You may have a tablet which doesn't have its own SIM slots in it. So what you can do is you can turn your smartphone into effectively a Wi-Fi hotspot, and then your Wi-Fi devices can use that data. Now, that relies upon two things. First and foremost, the plan that you're on with your particular mobile phone company has to permit tethering. It's also sometimes known as mobile hotspots. They have to allow it. okay, both technically and in terms of the contractual agreement. Over and above that, then the smartphone that you're using to turn itself into a mobile hotspot then has to have that capability, and most modern smartphones can do it. So it's usually a matter of whether the mobile phone provider allows it. Now, the other thing to say is that since the advent of 4G contracts, now that's data which use data capability which is of the faster type, so 4G as opposed to 3G or GPRS or what have you, there are no longer any all-you-can-eat tariffs. They are all capped. They may be capped at 1 gigabyte, 4 gigabytes, 10, 20 gigabytes, but they will be capped, and therefore you need to be aware of that and consider whether you know, you're going to be able to operate within those limits, because if you exceed those limits, it can get very expensive very quickly, because the rates that you pay over and above your cap, if it doesn't cut you off, can be punitive.
Okay, we've got lots more questions coming in. You can text them to 85058 or give us a call 0500 909 693. One here, which is from Gregory. I've got an iPad I want to get a mouse for to connect by Bluetooth. How safe are Bluetooth stacks to use? What are Bluetooth stacks, for starters?
Okay, so a Bluetooth stack, is... if you like, a queue of information that the devices can feed into and feed from. But iPads are not really designed to work with mice. I mean, there are ways around it, but it's not really... I would suggest it's not really the way to go. And I'd also question why you would particularly want to do it, given that you have a touchscreen right there. So it's an unusual use of it. The only times that I really have seen... iPads running with mice is when you're not actually running the iOS operating system on there, but you're using it to access something like a remote PC. So if you were using, let's say, software like Parallels Access, that would allow you to use your iPad as a screen to effectively dial in remotely to your computer at home. And under those circumstances, you know, a mouse would make more sense. But using the iOS operating system, which is a native software that comes with iPads and iPhones, it's not... I'm pushed to think of a good reason why you would want to do that. Because in fact, the whole thing about a tablet is it's more intuitive. You can actually reach and touch. You don't have to... you know, scroll on a space on a desk, which is the analog of the space on the screen. You can actually touch the screen. So I'm not sure why you would want to do that. You know, and I wouldn't say it's the way to go in most cases.
Okay, we've got a call, Fevzi. Bob in Chester is on the line. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, folks.
Good morning. How can we help?
Well, just to give you some idea of my age, I was a beta tester for Windows 95.
And oh, so bless you.
And so I ended up with a very short email address, just 3 digits, and I get junk mail like nobody's business.
Yes, but I bet you want to hold on to the email address, yes?
Oh, of course I do, yeah. So I normally drop to the bottom of the page, unsubscribe. But I'm beginning to wonder, is this counterproductive, or does it actually work?
Yeah, it's a good question. If the person or the organisation that sends you the email is reputable, and you will have to make that judgment by looking at the email, unfortunately, and you can't be sure, then they should respect the unsubscribe. If they are charlatans, then the fact that you click it makes things worse, because it tells them effectively that there's a real person receiving those emails, and that means that the email address becomes more valuable to spammers and they send you a whole lot more. My suggestion would be not to click unless you're sure it's from a reputable source and maybe something that you signed up for and therefore can, you know, unsubscribe from. I would tend to look at your spam filtering instead. And there are two ways that you can approach the problem of spam filtering, Bob. One is to get the emails filtered for spam, that's to say, you know, unwanted emails, before they reach your inbox, which has the benefit of doing a lot of the hard work for you, and particularly if you're accessing any of those emails on a mobile device, you know, spam uses up your as we've said, limited data. The other way of doing it is to run a spam filter of your own. So something like Norton Anti-Spam would be a good example of that. The benefit of doing that is that if you check for the spam on your own machine, you've got the ability to go in and look at those spam and make sure that they are really spam. Whereas if you allow an internet-based filter to do it for you, you'll never see the emails that it thinks are spam. So those are your choices. What sort of machine are you using, Bob, to access your emails?
A laptop and a desktop.
Okay, so now, these are running Windows, yes?
Is running Windows 10. There are usually two options to get out of it. One is a generic thing at the very bottom, which refers to whoever's sent spam.
Mm-hmm.
And the other one is the company that forwards it. It always appears to be two. One asks for your email address, the other doesn't.
Mm.
Is there any difference between the two?
Yeah, I mean, it will be specific to the email that you receive as to, you know, what those are. My suggestion is, if it's something you've signed up for yourself, then by all means go ahead and unsubscribe.
Sorry, I have not signed up for any of these. Yeah. They just arrived.
I would look at, and who's your email address with, if I may ask?
MSN.
MSN. Okay, so you can go into the MSN control panel and you can switch on a spam filter from there. An alternative is, one of the best spam filters in the business is from Google's Gmail spam filter. And what you could do, if you were so minded and you didn't particularly mind your emails routing through Google's systems, and if you trust them not to do anything nefarious with your emails, one of the best spam filters is the Gmail spam filter. So you could set up a free Gmail account and route your incoming emails via that and back into your inbox so that they get cleaned up by Google. Or, as I say, you can use a system on your own PC, such as Norton Anti-Spam or Kaspersky or one of other companies, and that will also do it for you. I personally wouldn't start clicking on unsubscribe, because unfortunately there are too many bad players, bad actors out there who will actually just use that as a way of discerning whether that email address is active, and then
exactly what I feared.
Yeah, and therefore, you know, for every one that you get rid of, you might end up with 10 more or 100 more. So I think, you know, if you can get effective spam filtering, then it really doesn't matter, because once you train it to say anything from there is spam, then you won't see it anyway, or at least you don't have to see it. It'll be put in a spare folder.
Right. Can I just ask you one more question? You mentioned
ahead.
A couple of companies there. How do you rate AVG as a virus protection?
Okay. These are a matter of opinion. I can only give you my opinion based on having used AVG and having used others. It wouldn't be my first port of call. AVG have some free products. I happen to be of the opinion that security software such as antivirus, anti-spyware, anti-spam is actually something worth paying for, and there are benefits in paying for it. AVG also have a paid-for product, but they have had some issues that would make me look elsewhere as a first choice. There are others that will disagree with that, but that's my personal view. And I've mentioned to you a couple of the ones that I've successfully used and trust.
Okay, that's fine. I do actually pay for AVG, and I really don't have any grudge against them. I just wondered how you rated them.
Yeah, I don't think they're the most effective solution, and I think that there have been some issues about the security of data and so forth. So for that reason, I would tend personally to choose another provider.
In other words, I'm in deep trouble.
No, not at all, because it is, you know, there are lots of AVG customers who are perfectly happy. And if you're happy, you're happy. The problem with security software, Bob, is that it's very hard to test. It's not like a car where you can, you know, just test it and directly compare it to others, because you're looking for it to catch viruses, but you only really end up testing it against a set of known viruses, and it's hard to test what are known as heuristics. So when you have, for example, antivirus software, they are programmed and updated with the signatures, the sort of the telltale signs of individual viruses. But in addition to that, they are programmed to spot suspicious activity, even if it's not associated with a known virus. And that's quite hard to test, because by definition you're testing for viruses that are not known, and the heuristic algorithms, the programming of trying to spot suspicious activity, is very hard to test. All I can tell you is that the ones that I've mentioned to you, I've used extensively and have had quite uniformly good experiences with. And for that reason, they would personally be where I would look first. But I wouldn't say you're in big trouble. I just think that, you know, when you're spending money and you're not looking at free option, then you've got a large range of companies to look at. Also, take a look at ESET. They're another good player, ESET.
Hopefully that all helps, Bob. I'm always amazed, Fevzi, every morning when I open my inbox in terms of the amount of spam that I get and the amount of mailing lists that I don't remember signing up to that I seem to get emails from on a daily basis.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. I mean, I literally get several hundred spam emails a day.
Yeah.
Partly because some of my email addresses are published.
Yeah.
And therefore, you know, there's very little you can do about that. And therefore, you know, I do tend to rely on filtering. And I personally tend to go, I don't filter in the cloud. I don't let my internet service provider filter it. I like to have the control, although it is less than ideal. One tip I would give you, and anyone else listening, is there are essentially two types of email. One is used to be the more common type, called POP3, and the other's called IMAP. And the difference is this: if you use your email on more than one device, with IMAP, if you filter the emails, let's say on your desktop using IMAP, then using IMAP email, then only those filtered emails will then make it onto your portable device, such as your mobile phone. And thereby you're saving a lot of your data allowance, because it's not downloading loads of spam. Spam filtering on mobile devices is woefully inadequate, unfortunately. And, you know, if that is the main way you access your emails, then you really don't have a lot of choice but to allow your internet service provider to filter it for you. Otherwise, you know, if you're getting loads of spam emails, it's going to just use up all your data for nothing, and you're going to spend all your time swiping to delete those emails manually.
I hate to think how much time I spend deleting all of those.
Yeah, whereas just imagine, let's say you had a desktop or a laptop computer, you leave it switched on, and you allow that to do the filtering, and you set up your emails as IMAP as opposed to POP3 or webmail, and then what will happen is it will filter them, it will get rid of them. But when it does so, it gets rid of them up, they're held up on the server. So where it deletes them, it's not just deleting it off the machine that's running that software, it's deleting them off the server. Therefore, when you then use your phone or your tablet to download those emails, they've already been swept and you only get the good ones.
Brilliant. I like this. I'm going to have to do this. We've got another call. Tony in York is on the line. Good morning, Tony.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well, thank you. How can Fevzi help you out this morning?
Yeah, sorry, I've just rushed in from work. I put a new computer in at Christmas, but the computer, I put it in. When I come to put my internet on, I can't get it to, it says my IP address will not configure when I put my Ethernet cable in. I can only do it wireless. And every time I try and put it on with a cable, Ethernet cable, it will not connect it.
And this is a laptop running Windows?
No, this is a desktop.
It's a desktop computer.
We're running Windows 10.
And it's right. Yeah. Okay. It can be that the firewall within Windows or any third party firewall that you're using may be blocking access to data going through those ports. So you need to see how that's been set up. It's quite unusual, the problem that you're having, Tony, in that it's normally the other way around. It's normally the wired connection that gets through cleanly and the Wi-Fi that tends to get blocked as being suspicious. But in most cases, it's down to the settings that you've got on your firewall. My guess, yeah. I mean, there can be other reasons for this, but my guess is that they're being blocked by your firewall. So your first step is to work out whether you're using the firewall built into Windows 10 or whether you're using some sort of third-party firewall. If you've installed a sort of internet security suite with, you know, antivirus and anti-spam.
Yeah, I've got Malwarebytes on there. And,
okay, have you got the free version or the paid version?
The free version.
Okay, so with Malwarebytes, the free version, that's an anti-spyware software. That's something that you run on an ad hoc basis to scan for any malware on your system. That would be unlikely to be the cause of the problem. It's more likely if you've
Windows
got...
Windows Defender. Is it Defender on there?
Yeah, so that could well be doing it. So you just need to work out what your firewall is, which one you're using, and look at the settings and make sure that it's not blocking any ports.
Right, because I remember I was listening to you last month and you were saying, oh, you best say, you know... You can go wireless, but you like it. I was best hardwired, and I thought,
Well, when it works, yes. I stand by the advice when it works. What I'm trying to say when I say it's best to go wired is that you get a more reliable connection. So wireless is good for things like emailing and a bit of web browsing. What it's not always ideal for is things like streaming, and in particular streaming video, where it's sort of mission critical. It has to keep, that data flow has to keep going. You can't have gaps in the service. It's a bit like a bus service. It has to be reliable so that you don't get stuttering and pausing of video as you play it back. And it's less susceptible to interference as well. So if you live in a location where, you know, you're surrounded by your neighbor's Wi-Fi as well, and maybe, you know, some cordless phones and baby monitors and everything else that's sort of bleeding into the electro smog, as it were, then a wired connection again will just cut through that. It won't be affected in the same way. So for those reasons, I would recommend a wired connection where you can. Wi-Fi has the advantage of convenience, but once you get that working, you will have a more solid connection than a wireless connection.
Fingers crossed that works out then, Tony. Keep the calls coming in, 0500 909 693 and the text to 85058. We'll go through a few more texts before we head to the news, Fevzy. Darren wants to know, is there any way I can change the keyboard from QWERTY when texting on a Samsung S3? I can't seem to see any way to do it.
There are. So Samsung S3 runs the Android operating system, and in Android there are alternative keyboards, but there are also third-party keyboards that you can download that will enable you to change to almost any sort of keyboard that you can imagine. And it's not just standard ones. There's ones where you can sort of swipe characters and so forth, that, you know, you use your finger across it to actually type or draw characters as you go. So there's actually a much wider variety available on Android than there is on Apple's iOS. iOS is a lot more controlling. Apple is more controlling of what you can run on it in terms of keyboards and other system utilities. But with Android, it's open season. The only thing I would say to you, Darren, is be careful, because with that freedom comes responsibility. And keyboard apps are kind of interesting, because if a keyboard is created by an individual or a business that's has bad intentions, they can use the app to capture everything that you type in through it. So if you do go for a third-party keyboard, make sure it's from a trusted source, and make sure that you read all the reviews, and you know it's been up there for a long time and everyone's, you know, speaking glowingly about it, and look for some independent reviews as well. Keyboard add-ons are particularly important, just because imagine if they want to do every single key press that you make, they can make a copy of it and get all your passwords and everything else that you enter via that keyboard.
This is BBC Five Live, available on the BBC iPlayer radio app. Up all night.
We're continuing our tech phone-in for the next hour with Fevzi, our gadget detective. If you have got any questions for Fevzi, 85058 is the text number. 0500 909 693 is the number to call if you want to ask your question in person. Fevzi, let's have a look at some of the things that are looking around in the tech world at the moment. And your gadget of the week is a Bluetooth speaker. Tell us a bit more about this, the Kitsound Hive Evolution.
OK, so I've quite literally got Bluetooth speakers coming out of my ears. I'm sorry to say. I mean, there are just so many of them that one would say, well, why would you review one? Well, I've tried to pick one that I think is arguably, based on having tried many, many of these, I think one of the best, if not the best, portable Bluetooth speaker out there. So it's from a company, they're not that well known. They're called Kitsound, one word, and the device is called the Hive Evolution. The word Hive, I think, comes because when you look at the front of it, it looks like a beehive.
It does.
Design.
It's quite pretty to look at.
I think it's very attractive. It's made of metal, so although it's quite small, so to give you an idea, it's about 7 inches across. The shape is like the cross section of an aircraft wing. If you imagine cutting an aircraft wing across, which is obviously not an advisable thing to do, it's that sort of oval type shape. It's about 7 inches across, about an inch and a half high, and about 2 inches deep. So small.
Yeah.
It's rechargeable, so you plug it in, you charge it up, and it goes for about 8 hours. So it's good for taking out to picnics and stuff. But this thing, despite its size, will fill a room with very decent sound without going to its maximum volume. Most speakers, by virtue of their design, if you take them much above sort of 7 or 8 out of 10 on the sort of volume scale, they start getting a bit ropey in terms of their sound. But this thing, you don't have to take it that high for it to fill a room. It's got a very impressive bass, particularly if you put it up near a wall. It sort of resonates in a way that if you close your eyes, you would really not know it was coming from a small device. It would sound like it's coming from something much larger. So that's why I've chosen it. In terms of specs, it's got 20 watts of power, and that's RMS power, which is the proper way of measuring watts, not the cheating way. it's got something called a monocoque aluminium chassis, and I believe I looked this up the other day because I had to learn what monocoque meant. I believe it's a structure where the skin of the device, the outer surface of the device, is what gives it its strength, rather like an aircraft wing. So it's got that sort of design. It's Bluetooth connectivity, which is very well implemented, so you can get up to 20 meters at range out of it, which is impressive. Also, if you have a non-Apple phone with NFC, so that's near field communication, when you have to pair the device, your mobile phone or your tablet to it, you just tap the device and it pairs automatically, rather like, you know, when you do contactless payment.
Yes.
You just tap it and it's bonded to it, which is very good. In terms of the connectivity, we've said it's got Wi-Fi, but it's also got sockets to actually have a wired input, and you know how I like wires, and you can also have a wired output as well. So it's I found it very good. I don't know how well a demonstration of this will work given the circumstances, but can I just give you a very quick blast of this?
Go for it.
Okay.
What we're going to listen to.
Now, that's running at about... Okay, I
sounds
think
good.
Just peeking over the place.
Bet your neighbours love you.
That's
20 to 3 in the morning.
Sorry about that. Yeah, they've had worse, frankly. They should consider themselves lucky. That's very that. Yes. Well, anyway, so that was running at about 2 or 3 out of 10 in terms of volume, just to give you an idea. It goes a whole lot louder than that.
Let's not do that. You'll definitely get some kind of ASPO.
In terms of price, it's not cheap. If you want a cheap one, you know, go and buy something like one of the Amazon Basics range for £20 or £30. They're excellent value for money. This thing's got a list price of £130,
okay.
But in practice, you pay about £100 for it. But honestly, I think it's money well spent. I use mine as an attachment for my Amazon Echo Dot unit. So,
yeah.
You know these sort of artificial intelligence devices.
Clever
things. Yeah. Just one little tip for people. You know, there's two versions of the Amazon Echo. There's the full-size one, which looks like a kitchen roller on its end.
Yeah.
That one's got a very nice built-in speaker, but actually no way of attaching an external speaker, either wired or wireless. You're stuck with that built-in mono speaker.
Okay.
Whereas and it's about £150, whereas the £50 one, the tiny little Echo Dot, which has pretty much the same functionality, it has all the same intelligence as the big one, has a wire output, because it has a tiny speaker, which is good for speech but not for listening to music, and it also has a Bluetooth output as well. So actually it works really nicely paired with this device.
You can connect them up
and you actually get better sound out of it. So the £100 price difference that you have between the two Echo units could pay for one of these, and you get substantially better sound out of that than you get out of the Amazon Echo with its very nice but mono built-in speakers.
So there you go. That's the Kit Sound Hive Evolution. And another story that you're looking at, Google's driverless cars, some progress being made on those.
Yeah, it's interesting because in California, where these things drive around, under Californian law, they require them to produce certain statistics about how they're being used. And one statistics they measure is something called disengagement incidents. That's where a human being has had to take back the controls from the self-driving car. And last year there were 124 disengagement incidents, but that compares to 341 in the previous year, despite the fact that about 50% more miles were done. So they did 636,000 miles last year and only 124 disengagement incidents, which I think is pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Particularly when you consider about 10 of those is because of some wally driver doing something unpredictable, nothing to do with them. So we are fast heading into the territory where not only do these things pass driving tests and drive well, they will drive better than us. And we're heading into that area. It's the same with cars. It will be the same with surgery. You know, when you're going for surgery, you're going to the hospital, you will be happy if it's a robot doing it, and you'll be less happy if it's a fallible human being with
hopefully
a shaky
you'll
hand.
Be asleep as well.
Yes, and... but these things exist. You know, there are things called Da Vinci robots that can do surgery, albeit under the control of a surgeon, but they do have the advantage of having very steady hands.
Yeah, incredible.
And being, you know, very finessed movements. So you can actually see that the way things are going with this, the idea, there was a comment the other day that said a child born now will probably never have a driving license.
Oh wow.
Because they won't need one in the same way that most of us can't ride horses, I guess.
I would have quite happily not done my driving test. I hated learning to drive, so a driverless car would be lovely.
I know, just imagine, a driverless car effectively is a cab.
Yeah.
And you can imagine the many benefits that will flow from that. First of all the things that you can do instead of having to drive. You know, it's a bit like being on a train. You can work, you can relax, you can, you know, put your feet up, do what you like. So it has all of those benefits, but also most cars spend most of their time parked.
Yeah.
And that's a terrible waste of resources in terms of space, but also in terms of the number of vehicles that you need. And just imagine your car takes you to work, but then because of a sophisticated system, it will then go off and take someone else shopping or take someone to a hospital appointment or whatever it is. And you can have a series of cars that are constantly in use, rather like taxis, but even more, I hate to say it, but even more efficient, because the intelligence that you could build into a network like that would is far more effective than people hailing taxis or using Uber to call for them. But Uber are investing heavily in this technology, as are others, and
yeah,
it's quite fascinating to see that, you know, the way that these intelligent systems will take us. So well done to Google's driverless cars for making progress. They've more than 50% improvement in 1 year.
Very good.
You can see the direction of travel in that, if you, again, pardon the pun.
Yeah, definitely. We've got lots of calls coming in, so let's get back to a few more people's questions. John in Acton is on the line. Good morning, John.
Oh, hello there.
Good morning. How can Fevzi help this morning?
Yes, I recently changed my PC. The one I had was pretty ancient, and in fact the one I've replaced it with is not brand new, but was given to me by a friend who didn't need it anymore. Everything seems to be working absolutely fine, except I can't get it to talk to my printer, which again is a fairly ancient bit of kit, but it does the job that I need it to do. The printer's a Hewlett-Packard LaserJet 2200. I have the original installation disk, and I've put that in. I've downloaded HP Print and Scan Doctor. I have, done all I can. And when it goes into printers and drivers, the little icon comes up for this particular printer. And whenever I try to print, the little tick that might have been by the icon just changes to a exclamation mark, and it says printer error. I should also say that I work remotely from home, and I contacted our IT department at work. They were able to, by whatever means, I can't remember now, but they were able to go into my computer as well. They tried everything they could do, and they couldn't get it to work. Okay. I'm just wondering if I need a new printer.
Go, Fevzy.
Right, okay, John.
Succeed where the IT experts at John's work couldn't.
So John, you've probably worked out that the issue here is most likely to do with what's called printer drivers. So a computer is a standardized piece of hardware running a standardized operating system, and on that computer you can insert many different devices into it and attach many devices such as printers to it. And the only real way in which the computer's operating system is able to communicate effectively with a particular computer is if the provider of that computer has produced a piece of bridging software that allowed the two to communicate, called a printer driver. I'm guessing that given that your old computer was very old and this one is less old, that they may well be running a different version of Windows to each other. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, the original one was Windows Vista, which I had on the other one. Okay. And this is Windows 2010.
Okay. So Office 2010.
Home Office 2000.
Okay, but what version of Windows is it?
Oh, sorry, 7.
7. Okay.
I was 2010 is the Microsoft
Vista,
2010, Home Office 2010.
I understand. Sorry, John. Although Vista and Windows 7 are very closely related, it is possible to have drivers that will run on Vista that won't run on Windows 7. It is less usual. If you'd said to me, Windows 95 and Windows 7, then I just say the chances of you getting that to work are slim. The thing to do here is to go to the HP website. You said it was an HP LaserJet,
That's
think.
That's correct, yeah.
Go to the HP website, go to the support section, and look for the latest version of the driver for your version of Windows. So in your case, it will be Windows 7, and it will either be the 32-bit or the 64-bit version, depending on which version of the Windows operating system you're running. Mm-hmm. Download the latest version and try that. If it doesn't exist, or there isn't a later version than the one that you're using, and there probably will be, printer drivers and HP are pretty good with drivers, so there'll probably be a more recent version. Hopefully that will solve the problem. Failing that, you could try and use sort of generic Microsoft drivers, but that will not, even if it works, it won't work completely well. And the third choice is there are some routers that disseminate the internet signal that have USB sockets in them that allow you to. Is that a USB printer, that one?
No, plug to put in the back of the computer.
So yeah, it's about sort of an inch and a half to 2 inches across.
That's the one,
yeah. Yeah, so that's a parallel printer port. Right. Okay, so my advice is if that doesn't work, time for a new printer.
And that's really what I think.
Okay, but I think that there's a fair chance that you will get it working, frankly, because Vista and 7 are not that far apart. If you are going to go for a new printer, John, I'll just give you a few pieces of advice. When buying a printer, you need to look at what the total cost of ownership of that printer is. So that's not just the cost of buying the printer and obviously the paper it takes, but it's also the cost of the ink or the toner that it consumes. And you need to be careful because some manufacturers will sell you a printer as a loss leader, below their actual manufacturing costs. They can sell you it for £20-30 even. in the knowledge that you'll then have to buy their ink, and they'll, you know, per cubic centilitre, it's more expensive than Dom Pérignon champagne. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that there are printer inks that are so expensive. And then your total cost of ownership goes up dramatically. So you need to think about how many pages you're likely to print per week or per month, and then look at what the running costs are going to be. And sometimes it's worth spending a little bit more on the printer to buy, in the knowledge that the running costs will be cheaper. But where the break-even point between the two approaches is depends upon how many pages you think you're going to print.
Yeah, so don't be lured in just by a good deal on a printer.
Yeah, it really is, you know, it's quite shameful the way that some manufacturers do behave over this. They are improving. I mean, I've got an inkjet printer here that actually has running costs superior to any laser. But I had to pay a few hundred pounds for the printer.
Yeah.
But in the long run, it saved me a few thousand pounds over the life of the printer.
There you go.
It just really depends on how much you're going to print and, you know, what you want to use it for. So have a think about that. Don't just go out and buy, if you do buy a new printer, just don't go out and buy necessarily the cheapest one. Do some research on what it will cost you to own and run.
Okay, hope that helps, John. We've got Elizabeth in York on the line. Good morning, Elizabeth.
Oh, good morning.
How can Fevzi help this morning?
I've got a desktop PC, and the DVD CD drive isn't showing up on anything at all. It's not showing up on Windows Media. It's not showing up when I go into, you know, the little sort of like yellow computer. I can't think of the name for it. I don't know what it is. Like the little yellow computer thing when you go to, you know, sort of like see what's on your computer kind of thing.
Yeah.
But when I go into Device Manager, it says this device is working properly. Mm. But I can't rip CDs. But what I was doing, I was ripping CDs from the CDs to my MP3 player, and I did two of them, and it was fine. And then it just suddenly stopped recognizing them. It said there's no disk in the drive, and then the drive just disappeared.
Okay, so Elizabeth, there are two possibilities that spring to mind. One is that it's possible that the drive has failed. You know, mechanically, more likely the driver. So we talked a bit in the last call about printer drivers, but the driver that makes that particular device work may have become corrupted. That's to say that, you know, it may have had a bit knocked off it, as it were. So it's worth updating that driver to the latest version or reinstating it if you have a disk. But usually it's worth downloading the latest driver. So you need to work out, again, what is the make and model of the CD/DVD player/recorder that you have there, and go to the manufacturer's site and download it from there. It may be that the software is also buggy. So, you know, that's the way I would go rather than try and, you know, replace it. It's obviously it's good that it recognizes it within Device Manager, but that's not enough. Also, it's worth bearing in mind, Elizabeth, that in addition to the driver software, there's another layer of software on top of that gives it the more intelligent functions that is what allows you to, you know, conveniently rip discs and so forth. And by the way, rip means copy for those that aren't sure of that particular piece of terminology. So people who don't want to use physical discs anymore will rip or copy their discs in either as compressed MP3 files or in a higher quality format and use them on some sort of digital jukebox type setup. People are increasingly doing that, and even people still buying new CDs, because when you subscribe to a sort of streaming music service or even a download music service, you often can't get CD quality music. Usually you can't get it. You get some sort of compressed affair, which is more similar to the quality of a cassette tape than a CD. And therefore, lovers of music often will still buy the physical CD and rip it themselves at full quality. In the past, you see, when internet speeds were slow and data was capped even at home, you know, it made sense that, you know, music be provided in this highly compressed MP3 format because it would take about a tenth of the data. But these days, there's no real reason for that other than the fact that they're kind of worried that you'll pass around copies of it, so they sell you a nobbled one. But if I'm paying for the right to use that music, and I understand it's a license, I don't own you know, the music per se, but I've paid for the right to use it. But I don't want to have digital rights management or you know, that stop me from sharing my music across my devices. So, you know, when I buy a physical CD, I can put that in any machine around the house. When I buy a cassette tape, I could put it in any cassette tape player. But with digital, they thought, okay, now's the time we can stop people from, you know, using it across all their devices. That's not right. And one way in which they try and discourage that is to sell you a nobbled version, or at least the license to a nobbled version. And these days, there's really no need. You know, phones, even a phone can, you know, carry hugely more than iPods ever could in the past. And, you know, data speeds are fast as well. So there's no reason why we shouldn't have full quality streaming and full quality downloads, but we don't. And therefore, ripping or copying of discs still has a role to play for those that want their music conveniently but at the best quality.
Well, hopefully that will help Elizabeth carry on with that. I got rid of all my CDs when I moved house last year. I don't have any left.
Yeah. Well, as long as you didn't get rid of all your vinyl, which of course is now very, very de rigueur.
This is very true, very true.
Amazing now, I think vinyl's outselling CDs.
Yes, it's crazy.
Yeah, I wonder how long that will last, but it's great. I mean, I must admit, I kind of... I got my my turntable out not long ago and unpacked my 1980s vinyl, and it, you know, it's still good.
As long as there are hipsters in this world, we will still have vinyl, don't worry. Let's squeeze one more call in before the news. Andrew in Clapham. Good morning, Andrew. How can Fevzi help this morning?
Right, good morning. It was really just some advice on a good pair of speakers to run from a laptop, but not Bluetooth. I want to use a wire.
Yeah,
because my laptop, it's fairly new, it's only about 3 months old, and it sits on my heat pad permanently. I use it as a desktop, so I got it hooked up to a screen and a keyboard.
Yeah,
and I just want some really decent speakers, because like you, I've also got the proper hi-fi and the turntable.
Yes.
I just want some better speakers for what I'm listening to occasionally on the laptop.
Okay. Have you considered hooking your computer up to your existing hi-fi system?
I have, but the speakers are very large. They're from the 70s, sort of early 80s, so they're very large, and I think that would be quite a job for the laptop to run them.
Well, yes, but the thing, what you can then do, because actually those speakers are probably excellent and will probably outperform much of what you would buy today at any sort of reasonable...
Tannoy.
Sorry?
A pair of Tannoys.
Yeah, yeah. What are they, Mercury M2s or what?
I think they are, yes.
Yeah.
I would have paid about a couple of hundred quid for them.
Yeah. And they're nice, yes, and they look nice, and they're made of real wood and all the rest of it. And you've got an amplifier, yes?
Yeah, Series 2.
So you've got an amplifier that drives those speakers, and that amplifier will have an auxiliary input of some sort, a line-level input that you could use. Now, you're quite right... There we go. That's that. That's my Wi-Fi speaker just saying, I've had enough, I'm switching off now. Sorry about that. So what you need is some form of audio interface. And you're quite right to say you're not going to use the one built into your computer. Did you say it's a laptop?
Yeah.
Yep. So the sound circuitry in a laptop is particularly poor, usually. One, because it's built to a price where, you know, most laptop users aren't hi-fi fans, and, you know, these days, it's more to do with quantity than quality with music. It's how many tracks can I fit on, not how good does each of those tracks sound. So because they're built down to a budget, and sometimes, the budget for the sound in a laptop can be a couple of quid. You know, it can be really, really cheap. And therefore, the thing to do is to have some sort of audio interface that takes the sound digitally, typically out of a USB port on your computer, and converts it into a line level output, which you can then use to feed your amplifier.
Yes.
Now, there are various devices that will do that. They're typically known as audio interfaces. You could look at a simple box from a company like Focusrite, for example. That's Focusrite. There are so many others of these. I'm struggling to think. Now, some of these devices, they just look really tiny and just plug, you know, just sit, it really is a part of the cable almost from USB to line out. But if you get a bigger box, if you get a full audio interface, that will be a lot more flexible. You can connect it to many more things. You'll get a better headphone amplifier built into it as well, which you can then use at the same time. So you could use something like that. You could use something from, there's a company called iConnectivity, and they do a range of excellent audio interfaces, which are also very flexible. By the way, they've just launched something that's great for ripping all your vinyl, by the way. I noticed it at the recent music show. They've just done that. So look for a quality audio interface. And my suggestion would be to use your existing amp and your existing speakers. It's going to be cheaper. You're going to get better quality. And they're already taking up whatever space they're taking up.
Absolutely.
So you don't need to add more to it.